From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Home to Harvard, Yale, MIT, Berkeley, Michigan, American universities have long dominated the landscape of higher education across the world. Most of the 100 top-rated schools worldwide are in the U.S., but there are challenges on the horizon: faulty business models, impossible admission standards, misused budgets. They strain American families and the schools themselves. If universities don't change, my guest argues, the country could lose its brightest minds overseas and fall far short of the job it must do, educating undergraduates. This hour, On Point, the threats to American universities and the way forward. You can join us on air or online. Parents, is your child looking at colleges? Are you overwhelmed? Students, are you struggling under the weight of debt? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Jonathan Cole, university professor at Columbia University, former provost and dean of faculties there. He's also a trustee of Boston University, which owns the license for WBUR. His most recent book is Toward a More Perfect University. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jonathan Cole, welcome to On Point.
It's good to be with you, Ray.
So it's a massive piece of work, and there were lots of points where you can celebrate all that American universities have accomplished, and lots of points where the situation seemed kind of dire, and sometimes I wasn't sure where you were coming down.
Well, I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, there's no question that the American higher education system is the finest in the world, and it is so because at the very best universities, I think we provide an extraordinary educational opportunity for those who go to those schools. But also, perhaps equally important, is the discoveries and innovations which have changed our lives and have changed the lives of people around the world have largely come from our American research universities. Nonetheless, many people think that the challenges to the United States will come from abroad, like China or Japan or India. I argue that that's not true. They're really not the true competitors. The real possibility is that, as Walt Kelly, his famous cartoon character Pogo, said once, he said, "I've seen the enemy and he is us." So I am concerned about the ways in which we are behaving as a nation that undervalues colleges and universities and puts us at risk from falling from preeminence and making us far more pedestrian than we really are today.
We're at this peculiar moment in American higher education where aspirational families in the rest of the world are trying to position their children to gain admission to an American university, while if you talk to parents here, go to a PTA meeting at an American public high school, and people are really flummoxed by the choices, by the cost, by the fear of their kid making a bad choice, of how it feels almost that these years are irretrievable, that there's no room for error. When you talk to 17-year-olds who have resumes, it feels like the whole thing is sort of spinning out of control, while at this very moment, somebody's taking Kumon math in Jakarta so they can take the SAT and get to a UC system school. It's a weird moment.
Yes, I think it really has become a tragic moment. I mean, in New York City, for example, in Manhattan, we have 3- and 4-year-olds who are taking standardized tests, and if they don't do well on them, their parents are so disappointed because they think their children will no longer have an opportunity to get into Yale or Harvard or Stanford or Columbia or places like that. I mean, that's an absurdity. There are many, many great colleges and universities in this country, and yet we as educators have done a very poor job at educating the public about what the opportunities are, what the real costs are, how affordable these colleges may be, and in fact, making the choices that make them more affordable and more accessible to those people who have talent but may not have the economic means to choose colleges that they think are too expensive.
With all this free-floating anxiety out there, it's no surprise that college has featured in the national conversation in the presidential race. A pillar of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign has been making college free. Here he was after winning the New Hampshire primary in February.
We need the best educated workforce in the world. Yes, we are going to make public colleges and universities tuition free.
In January of 2014, at an event at a General Electric plant in Wisconsin, President Obama, a graduate of Columbia University, suggested vocational paths are more valuable than certain liberal arts degrees.
A lot of young people no longer see the trades and skilled manufacturing as a viable career, but I promise you, folks can make a lot more potentially with skilled manufacturing or the trades than they might with an art history degree.
A rough moment for all art history majors coast to coast. And during this campaign season, we heard Florida Senator Marco Rubio deploring philosophy majors and extolling welder trainees. Is this a false choice, Mr. Cole?
I think it's partially a false choice. I certainly think that denigrating the humanities and philosophy and subjects like that or art history is not the way we ought to proceed. After all, these are extraordinarily important subjects that are at the heart, really, of great universities. They are the subjects in which people really begin to learn a set of values and to internalize those values. It also is probably the way in which people learn to think critically, to write well, as well as to be critics of the society in which they live. And that's very important, and we should not eliminate that. Nonetheless, that being said, I don't think that college has to be for 100% of Americans. I think there can be people who choose to go to vocational schools, and it should be perfectly acceptable and prestigious, in fact. But it doesn't offer us very much prestige.
I think those arguments point to a greater problem that we haven't decided for ourselves what college is for, what it's supposed to do, and who it's for. That's still unsettled, contested terrain.
I agree with that. I think that, in my book, Toward a More Perfect University, I try to outline what are some of the objectives of colleges. And in fact, the colleges themselves often have not defined what they believe students going to them, those colleges, ought to come out with, what kinds of values they ought to have, what kinds of skill sets they ought to have. What are the colleges trying to do for the students during that four-year period? Are they trying to increase critical reasoning skills, better writing, better ability to work with many other people? What precisely are their objectives? And they are not well defined by our American colleges at this point.
Should we have a better filter, a better set of metrics, a better way of assessing universities that are knowledge factories, the great research universities that you celebrate in your book, and places where an 18-year-old can spend 4 years and get a great foundation for the rest of their lives through excellent undergraduate education?
Well, I think we should. I think we need a different kind of metrics. We ought to be able to begin by asking ourselves at these colleges what constitutes a really good admit and what constitutes a failure on our part. In other words, we ought to look at what might be called false negatives and false positives. The false positives are those people we admit, but who really don't go on to do any of the kinds of things that we hope that they will. The false negatives are people who are rejected, people like Richard Feynman was rejected by Columbia University. I would say, in retrospect, that was the mistake to reject one of the great physicists of the 20th century. But what are the criteria that we are using? Unfortunately, I think we are using the wrong criteria to establish who is eligible to get into the most selective colleges. And that is a great mistake. And in my book, I suggest a complete revision of the way in which we do undergraduate admissions.
From our website, Jeff writes, we need to offer an alternative to the current college system, which would create competition between colleges and universities and this new education system, resulting in lower prices. So what we really need is an education system that can give students the skills to jump into a middle-class job within 6 months to a year of entering that system. A lot, Jonathan Cole, of the conversation around how we prepare young Americans for their adult years is an economic conversation. You could see it here in Jeff's remarks.
Yes, I think there is a tremendous concentration, and understandably so, for how college prepares you for the job market. I think that's a bit unfortunate because, you know, people are living their lives now. They don't go to college only to find out how they're going to fare in the job market. They should be learning now, developing now, having experiences that are very valuable for them at this particular time. If they're well prepared in terms of their writing skills, their reading skills, their interaction with other people, their interactions with professors, their learning by doing, actually engaged in some kind of research, I think that they will find jobs in the job market, and they will be very innovative. But if they only look at college as a means to an end, a practical end of a job, which is somewhat understandable, but nonetheless, I think, wrong.
Jonathan Cole completed his education at Columbia University during the 1960s, and in subsequent decades taught there and helped run the place. But instead of taking his Mr. Chips victory lap on 116th Street, he's writing about how to help change the American university for the 21st century. We're talking about the internal threats to American universities and the way forward. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We've been talking about the struggles American universities can expect to face in the future, and you can join the conversation. How do you think American universities are doing at their primary jobs? Are universities around the world catching up? My guest, Jonathan Cole, university professor at Columbia University and author of the book Toward a More Perfect University. Vince is with us now, calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Vince, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in a situation right now, well, both my wife and I are in a situation where we are mired in student loan debt. I'm actually a veteran, and I did have the post 9/11 GI Bill. However, because I went to an out-of-state school that didn't participate in the Yellow Ribbon program, I still had to take out student loans to subsidize the rest of my education, and she did as well. The irony that we're both in is that if we didn't have our college educations, we wouldn't be working the jobs that we have now, which afford us a fairly comfortable lifestyle, but still, it feels like every month we're paying a fortune for the college education that we have. And I was just calling to see if there were any suggestions about, you know, lowering the price of tuition, making public universities give veterans in-state tuition, or things of that nature, because it's frustrating when you, get a check and every month you're given a good portion of it away to pay for an education. So that was my only comment. Thanks.
Professor Cole?
Yes, I mean, this is a wonderful observation and allows me to talk a little bit about the problem of student debt, which for many people is getting really out of hand. Nonetheless, here is what I think some things that should be done in the future are. One is the states in this country over the last 8 years have actually reduced their allocations to their own state universities, public universities, by roughly 30%. At the same time, the state of California, for example, has increased their allocations for prisons and incarceration by 130%. Now, when you begin to reduce your investments in one of the institutions that has huge payoffs, what do the universities do? They tend to raise tuition, and that produces more debt. Another example is that the federal government offers student loans. And those loans are often at favorable rates, but they're still 5 or maybe 6%. And that creates real problems for graduates. Now, as Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, has said, the banks charge about 1% for the banks to get money. Students are paying 5 or 6%. If we were to lower the interest rates from 5 or 6% to 1%, it would wipe out an enormous amount of debt that exists for students. So the federal government and the state governments are party to this very problem, and they have solutions. There are choices. You can choose to invest in education rather than incarceration. If it costs $60,000 a year to have an inmate in a California prison, you could send probably almost 10 students to a Berkeley with financial aid for that cost. Aren't we better off educating our population than incarcerating them? And isn't the government better off if we have people who are productive and can use their productivity and their college degrees to an advantage, rather than saddling them with interest rates which are as high as they currently are? So our state legislators, as well as our federal government, have got to make some very hard but important choices, and that is to lower the burden of the cost of college education for many people who are very talented but otherwise cannot really afford to do it without taking out massive amount of debts. Now, I must say at the same time that if you look at the city of New York and you look at the City University of New York, 60% of those students go without paying any tuition. Their financial aid covers all of their tuition costs. It doesn't mean that they don't graduate with some debt because they have living costs and expenses and things like that. And similarly, in places like Michigan and California, there are programs which reduce the cost of tuition from the sticker price to the actual price, which might be affordable except for the fact that these loans carry very high interest rates relative to what banks are paying, for example, and because of the fact that the universities and colleges are forced to increase tuition because the state is taking away funds which had previously gone to those colleges and universities.
In the living memory of many people listening to this program, it used to cost close to nothing to attend a public university, and you remind us in the book of the tremendous innovation of the public land-grant university. And it wasn't just established for idealistic reasons. It was a smart, hard-nosed investment in your own future workforce. In 2011, Texas Governor Rick Perry announced his plan for a $10,000 college degree. There was a lot of pushback from some of the research universities in Texas. Here's University of Texas at Austin President Bill Powers speaking in May 2011 about the importance of research universities.
The state of Texas needs not only large numbers of college graduates, it needs large numbers of graduates who have learned to thrive in the kind of educational environment that operates at the frontier of what is known and what is not yet known. The ability to produce these kinds of advanced degrees attracts business. It gives Texas the capacity to support innovation and advanced technology. It feeds the rest of the educational ecosystem.
But is it either or more like both and? Let's go to Lowell, Mass., home of a branch of the University of Massachusetts. Jared is calling. Hiya, Jared.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm a student at the University of Massachusetts. I just took a couple of years off and I went back. Right now, I'm only taking two classes. I'm a commuter and my tuition is over $3,000 only for these two classes. When I was full-time as a commuter, I was paying $12,000 to $15,000, and I refused to take out any loans. I either had my parents help pay or I worked my way through. And even doing that, it's still hard to support myself in the ways that my parents told me when they were growing up. My dad, he would just work two jobs and he was fine. He was able to support himself and make it through. I had two roommates. I worked full time. We all did. We could hardly even afford to our rent and to live week to week, let alone go to school at the same time. So there's something ridiculous going on. It's very obvious nowadays.
You know, Jared, I'm 32 years older than my son. And when my son was getting ready to go to college, he applied to my alma mater, New York University. And in those 32 years, the cost of being one semester's full load went up 1,100%. Now, I put myself through NYU working at a counter at a convenience store at $2.25 an hour. While NYU's tuition was going up 1,100%, the wage for that entering the job market job did not go up 11 times. Nobody was paying counter boys, counter clerks at convenience stores $25 an hour. So one thing went way out ahead of another in your ability to pay. So, Professor Cole, even when someone wants to continue to work in order to pay their way through so they don't borrow all the money, college just ran out ahead. The cars didn't go up 11 times in price in those same years. The cost of a loaf of bread didn't go up 11 times, and neither did people's salaries.
Well, I think that you touch on an extremely important point, and let me try to divide my response in two ways to the comments made by the president of the University of Texas, but also to our listener who makes a very, very good point. We have to distinguish between sticker prices, which are very high, and the extent to which the colleges themselves are funding financial aid if they don't have large endowments. Now, a place like Harvard, with a very, very large endowment, guarantees that all of its students will graduate without any debt. That's not true at most places, however, but there is a discount price and a discount rate, which is far lower than the sticker price. But most of the public really only hears about the $50,000 that is being charged by these colleges. In fact, the actual number of the cost is much lower. Now, the sons of and daughters of billionaires should pay the $50,000, but those who really come from family without a substantial means should be able to go at a minimal price. And so we need to have a very graduated tuition kind of structure, and that has to be put into place. It has to be much more like the Ivy League schools, which have a need-blind, full-need financial aid policy. And the government is going to have to help out if it wants to have a strong economy, if it wants to have innovation in the United States, and it wants to be a leader in education in the United States.
Well, now, I just got done paying tuition to your alma mater, Columbia University, not for myself, but for my lovely daughter. And neither a billionaire nor a member of a struggling family. And boy, it was rugged. I got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that's the second point here. And that is that one of the real causes for the kinds of problems that are being articulated by some of the call-in people and what you've just articulated is the stagnation of wages for most people in this country over the last 30 years compared to the upper 1%. I mean, when we talk about the inequality of wealth and the inequality of income, it has a direct bearing on the affordability of colleges and universities. Since wages are not going up and the costs of colleges are going up, even the savings which are created by the progressive sector of our economy, which manufactures television sets, cars that have high levels of productivity and can still maintain quality, that isn't being felt in the more stagnant areas where it's harder to get productivity growth without losing quality. And that is fundamentally because wages in the middle class, even the upper middle class, as well, of course, of the people without means, is just stagnating. And we as a society refuse to do what we need to do, and which is to create higher marginal tax rates, for example, or to allocate funds to universities rather than prisons. In other words, these are matters of national choices. We can make college affordable for people in this country, but we have to have the will and the knowledge about what is necessary to be done in order to make that experience affordable. And part of that lies in a different form of taxation and allocation to high priorities like education.
Jonathan Cole, stand by. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Richard Vedder joins us now from Athens, Ohio. He's an economist studying higher education, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, and a professor of economics emeritus at Ohio University, author of the book Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much. Richard Vedder, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you, Ray.
What is it about the business model of the modern college that's driving these tremendous increases in tuition and fees?
Well, there are several things at work. And it's true, for example, that it's very colleges and universities are very labor-intensive operations. They're not easily adaptable to technological change, cannot bring about enormous productivity improvements like it can in the automobile industry, for example. But I do think that some public policies that we've taken over the last several decades have led to the tuition price explosion to a very considerable extent, especially the federal programs, which now by some measures approach $200 billion a year in the total amount of money involved. These programs have pushed up tuition. I would argue that had tuition fees gone up after 1980, like they had gone up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we wouldn't be having this conversation about student loan debt and so forth. Tuition fees have been pushed up enormously, and it's not, and I would disagree a little bit with Professor Cole, it's not simply because in the last few years, state governments have cut back appropriations. The cost of going to Columbia and NYU has risen just as it has at many of the public schools, and those schools are not receiving public appropriations. So I could go on and on, Ray, but I probably should stop there.
Well, one of our listeners writes on Facebook, Candace, people need to stop being willing to pay the extortionate cost of private schools and degree mills. If people are willing to pay for it, nothing will change. I'm wondering if Americans sort of surrendering to these pricing models has given them the colleges and universities pricing power that wouldn't exist with other products that we buy.
Well, there's some truth to that. It's true. I mean, you look at Columbia or you look at Harvard, the number of applicants is many, many, many times the number of acceptances. So they have no problem maintaining these high fees. And indeed, if they wanted to, they could raise them even further. So there is some truth to that. But I would point out, however, that there is some signs that price resistance in higher education is beginning to rise. Not so much at the elite universities that Dr. Cole has talked so much about, but at other institutions. Total enrollments, the National Student Clearinghouse shows us that total enrollments in American higher education today are actually slightly lower than they were 4 years ago, that the enrollments have stagnated in the United States in the last few years. Tuition fees, and I'm talking net tuition fees, like Dr. Cole was, that is, after discounting, have not been rising the 5 and 6 and 7% a year they were. There is a number of colleges that have had enrollment declines that are on the, and some of them are in rather severe financial condition because of problems that have arisen. And so sensitivity to the cost of college is becoming more and more apparent to the average American. The value of colleges is becoming somewhat more suspect to many of them because there are risks of going to college.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. In for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the issues with American universities, the steps needed to face them. You can join the conversation. Is college too expensive? Are you looking at alternatives? Taking online courses? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Jonathan Cole, university professor at Columbia University and author of the book Toward a More Perfect University, and Richard Vedder, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. In November, students across the country marched as part of the Million Student March, demanding tuition-free public college and cancellation of student debt. Here's the group at UC San Diego. No cuts, no fees. Education should be free. What I want to do is hear from a group of listeners. I suspected this show would touch a nerve. Let's go hear several voices at once, and then I'll have Professors Vedder and Cole respond to your concerns. Let's go first right here to Boston, Mass. Lynn is calling. Welcome, Lynn.
Hi. Thanks, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. So I was wondering if your guests, could address the issue of high education costs and how that might relate to administrative costs and the burgeoning faculty and administration and buildings and sports arenas, that kind of thing.
So a lot of costs that don't directly concern classroom instruction.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll get them to respond. John is with us now from Glastonbury, Connecticut. John, welcome.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I used to run a private vocational school, and one thing that occurs to me is that we've misled a whole generation of kids, telling them that they needed a college degree, and it didn't matter what that degree was. And my question is, we incentivize all different types of things that we want to promote, like green energy, solar panels, fuel-efficient cars. Why aren't we incentivizing folks financially for STEM-type degrees versus some of the other degrees that are absolutely not going to make them marketable in the workforce?
So when you say incentivize, when you say subsidize, how would that work? What kind of mechanism are you talking about?
Well, we've got Pell Grants, we've got the GI Bill, we've got all kinds of different mechanisms for helping students fund, maybe discounted loans, different things. I completely reject Rich's idea that Senator Warren's solution is the 1% discount rate that are offered large companies for very short-term, low-risk loans. I think that is just nonsense. It's pandering to a group of folks and doesn't reflect anything. Any knowledge of how finance works, how risk works. But I think some, measured initiative, I'm sure we can come up with something to help folks in these fields where we're having to import students from all over the globe with these H-1Bs to fill jobs that we could be filling here, but we've got a whole group of students taking, liberal arts degrees or women's studies degrees, and they're not filling these jobs right here in America. And I think it's just delusional to think that, not having some sort of incentive, like they're doing across in other parts of the world, to promote high tech. I mean, it's just a no-brainer to me.
John from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Well, I'll take that up with my guests. And finally, Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. Chris, welcome to the program.
If anybody wants to see a worst-case scenario about what could possibly happen, all they have to do is go online and do a bit of investigating about what has happened to the University of Wisconsin system since Scott Walker became governor. And I've been researching this institution for 3 years. This was a mess waiting to happen. 5 years ago, he shut down the collective bargaining rights of faculty and staff. And just last month, the Board of Regents passed a resolution that says that any chancellor on any campus can shut down a non-profitable and lay off all the faculty, even full tenure professors, in essence denying everyone their tenure. People from all over the world are canceling their contracts to come here, and some of the primary faculty at our major research institutions are moving out and taking their institutes with them. It is a nightmare, and there has been a lot of protests. People can go on the American Association of University Professors websites at both Madison and Milwaukee and pull up. There are a series of essays by professors. There are a couple of other issues I want to bring up. The first is that our universities have become very top-loaded money-wise. A lot of the people that are running these institutions are not really educators. What they're interested in are the 6 and 7 figure incomes that they're getting. Nancy Zimfer at SUNY is making more than $1 million in salary and perks, and she you know, stepped her way up into that position. And the other thing is that our Board of Regents is 80% lawyers. There aren't hardly any educators. The educators that are on the Board of Regents protested this stuff, but they didn't get anywhere because they're not interested in educating people. They're just interested in money.
Well,
so
Chris,
that's all I really have to say.
Great. Thank you for your call, Chris from Wisconsin, Dells, Wisconsin. Well, gentlemen, there you have it. Some interesting observations there. Professor Vedder, right before the break, you were saying that it wasn't dwindling state funding that was driving some of these costs, but our caller points out that they're moving into crisis in the Wisconsin system because the state has made a decision to support the university in a very different way.
Well, the Wisconsin situations happen. There's a lot of variation in state funding across the country. If you were to look, say, at North Dakota, or, for example, in the last decade, there's been an enormous increase in funding. So the experiences vary. I think the callers, and two of the three callers, spoke to the issue of rising administrative costs at university, the sort of edifice complex that universities have entered into, where they've done enormous amounts of very expensive building, fancy building with atriums and lazy rivers and so forth. I do think that these costs tend to be sometimes overstated as a part of the problem, but they are real. And the administrative staffs at universities have grown rather dramatically in the last 25, 50 years. If you look at the data, some of that is justifiable because of changing public policies and so forth, but I think some of it is not. The caller who talked about we ought to subsidize more of the STEM disciplines, and that there are some majors, I think women's studies was specifically mentioned, that are a relatively low paying type jobs and where there's very little payoff to society. That gets to the issue of, Dr. Cole raised this himself earlier, about what the purpose of college is and so forth. But I do think we will, with scarce resources, have to think about whether we should be supporting all types of college research attendance at and majors at the same level. And I think that's an interesting policy question, whether a sociology major who is likely to make $25,000 or $30,000 a year should be supported at the same rate as an engineer who might make $60,000 or $80,000 starting. So I think those are interesting issues.
Professor Cole, let's talk about administration. You were a vice president in the College of Arts and Sciences, a provost of Columbia University. You know this world intimately. Are universities more top-heavy?
Well, I think there is increased administration, but I don't think that really accounts for the major problems of cost increases. There's a study that just recently come out of Boston, of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, called the Lincoln Project, which demonstrates quite clearly, with a lot of empirical information, that the major the major factor in the increased tuition is the cutbacks by the states. To some extent, it is these increases in administrative positions. But those increases in administrative positions, I want to point out, is many ways mandated by federal policies. Let me give you an example. There are 4,000 regulations of research at research universities that come from the federal government. It is now estimated that an individual who gets a research grant from the National Institutes of Health spends roughly 40% of her or his time filling out paper rather than doing the research that they were funded to do. 11% of college budgets are now being allocated to responding to federal regulations of one kind or another. So some of the responsibility for this is really these ongoing regulations, many of which never have a sunset clause, never disappear. They have no efficacy as far as anyone can tell. There's another factor here, though, that I think we should really acknowledge. Colleges and universities compete with each other for students, and increasingly students want the best sports arenas. They want to be able to have the best facilities to work out. They want the best rooms possible. In other words, families, when they go around, are looking for many, many things which are not part of the academic mission of the university per se. So that is also driving up some of the costs. Now, let me respond finally to one of the caller's observations about incentivizing STEM subjects. I think that would be a huge mistake. There are many ways to live a life, and many people who do not necessarily fill STEM positions or are even necessarily interested in STEM subjects can live productive, fruitful, and contributing lives to our democracy. And many of them who do not major in STEM subjects are extremely valuable people in the job market. So I think this differentiation is ill-conceived. When it comes to creativity, America does very, very well. If you look at the discoveries and innovations produced at our major research universities, you will find that we dominate the kinds of innovations that people don't even realize are coming from universities. For example, how many of the public know that the magnetic resonance imaging or global positioning systems or the Google algorithm or the FM radio all had their origins in research universities? We can't really forget that. And the fact of the matter is we have an enormous number of people. Some of them are people who come from abroad who want to stay here and would make wonderful citizens in the United States. But there are other young people who have interests other than STEM subjects and should not be penalized by the incentivization, which really means let's pay more tuition if you happen to be interested in the arts or interested in philosophy or interested in sociology or economics than you are in science, engineering, or mathematics. I think that's a very, very poor way for us to move forward and not a way to solve the fundamental problems that we have in American higher education.
But we are trapped in such an interesting marketplace, a bizarre marketplace, where perceptions of value drive economies that would be impossible in other realms. The $25 Timex with a quartz movement keeps the same exact time as a $10,000 Swiss-made watch with an old-fashioned spring movement in it that in many cases doesn't even tell as good time as the Timex. Yet people are willing to pay based on perceptions of value that they hold for themselves. It is a crazy thing when you take that kind of world of perceptions of value and apply it to majoring in a subject in a highly selective college where artificially created scarcity creates a marketplace where you can actually get away with charging $70,000 for an undergraduate position versus one in a nearby state where it's $18,000 instead. Professor Vedder, where is this all heading?
Well, that's a good question. The price of college cannot rise faster than people's incomes forever. It's mathematically impossible in the long run. We have scarcity. We do have many needs as a nation. We have an aging population. That means that our entitlement needs to meet the obligations that we have incurred as a nation are huge. Unfunded federal liabilities are over $100 trillion by some measures. I'm counting Medicare and so forth, as well as Social Security. So colleges have to become different. They have to stop growing as prices have to stop growing as fast as they have. It may be the mission will need to change. Incentives are needed within colleges to lead us to become more efficient. They're lacking now to a large extent. We don't have even good metrics or information on how well students are doing. Do the seniors at Columbia University know more in any fundamental sense than the freshmen that enter? Probably they do, but how do we measure that? We don't really know. So I think that there is need for that. There is a revolution coming. Maybe that's too strong of a word. That a major transformation is coming to higher education in the next decade or two, and I think that universities are going to have to adapt to that.
Richard Vedder, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.
And Jonathan Cole, university professor at Columbia and author of Toward a More Perfect University. Great to have you with us today.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Today's hour was produced by Maeve Pages, On Point's superstar intern in her maiden voyage around the hour. Coming up tomorrow, actor Ethan Hawke. He portrays jazz trumpeter Chet Baker in the new film Born to be Blue. Ethan Hawke, tomorrow on Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.